That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Happy May. This is Heidi Hatch with KUTV 2 News in another edition of Take 2 with Greg Hughes in the house, Mara Carabello.
Hello.
And slight disappointment, last week we had our inaugural video posting to YouTube, which people apparently are eating up and they love. And then Heidi Hatch, who's in charge of this, is having some technical difficulties. So we're going to have a lull this week where there will be no
video.
So
that was more of a soft launch. Some good views.
Yeah.
It was well received.
Yes.
Well received.
So we're all looking spiffy because we thought we were going to be on camera. So you'll just have to imagine what we're wearing.
No, I'm not.
Yeah.
Yeah. Greg's in a three-piece suit and he looks like an NFL.
You're layered though, kind of like preppy with the collar and then like a hooded sweatshirt over top.
Hoodie. This is like the new golf thing, by the way. Hoodies. You ever see if you watch a PGA tournament?
It's a quarter zip hoodie. I like it.
It's the Travis Matthews golf hoodie with the little zipper in the front.
You're looking sharp.
Thanks. For you that can't see because we don't have the YouTube.
Is Travis Matthew the store that has like the dad bod mannequin out front where it has a little bit of a gut and then it has the t-shirt on and it's just like we work with your body or whatever?
I haven't seen that, but
at Fashion Place Mall.
It is.
Yeah,
like
it meets
by the Apple
demo.
Store?
Yes.
Yes.
It meets the demo, so probably yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You're looking good.
You're looking good.
Thank you.
All right. Well,
that was the most backhanded compliment.
You don't have a dad bod, but every time I see Travis Matthews, I think of that mannequin they have out front.
You remind me of that schlumpy mannequin.
You're looking sharp and fit right now.
I feel like the last week I have aged in dog years. A lot has happened, and I'm just like, whew.
It's exhausting.
We got out of the podcast on Friday. We had serious things happening in Utah. We had a Vernal police officer who was shot. He's still in the hospital. And then there was shooting after shooting across the country of other police officers. We don't have time to tackle the issue of police officers and the problems today, but we had that. And all of a sudden we were like, hey, the campuses in Utah are quiet. There's no protests.
I think this podcast might have contributed to the uprising because I think Mara was saying our kids here are boring. And I was saying they're not pro-terrorists and anti-Semitics and nobody wanted me to praise them and no one wanted to be shamed by Mara. So they went out there and protested.
And then
your finger is on the pulse.
Thank you. Thank you. Exactly I think this happened. Show ignited the protests in the University of Utah and USU.
And the caucus was a hell of a night.
Oh, my gosh. That was
the convention.
A train
wreck. Yeah, the convention. Sorry, not the caucus. Now, I actually listened to Greg on the radio. I was at a track meet, and I wanted to go get warm in the car for a minute. And I'm like, do you know who I could listen to right now? Greg.
Yeah, you broadcast live.
Yeah. But your show ended before the real juicy, meaty craziness of the event happened.
Meaning it ended in the
daylight
hours?
Oh, during the day, yeah. Yeah, probably the nicest things said were probably during that broadcast from 3 to 5. But it was 17 hours. They were making final votes in the 3rd Congressional District and for Senate in the 11 p.m. hour. They were contractually obligated to be out of the building by midnight, which they did not meet. But there is not one person who lives outside of the Wasatch Front who could have been there at the 7:30 start and been able to get home in 4 hours and even have a Sunday left the next day. And so it was a disaster. It was the worst. I've been going to conventions since 1992, and there's never been a more poorly organized convention that I've ever attended.
All right. Well, we're going to talk more about the convention in a minute, but did you enjoy your Saturday without a convention?
I did. I mean, I was keeping up. I was texting my friend Greg Hughes during that day. But no, nothing is worth that. It was a rainy day. I mean, it should have even done well because I'm trying to remember what I did. But what I didn't do is spend the day at the
They didn't have food and water there.
They didn't?
No.
So this was...
No. There was no outlets to eat.
Seriously?
No.
I mean, the whole thing was bush league. Okay, we'll get to that later.
I know. I feel like I want to talk about that now, but I want to tackle the issue that I think has kind of been enveloping Utah and the country all week long, the college campus protests. And we were talking about that Axios article last week saying, hey, maybe we're different in Utah. And largely we have remained the same. Utah State had a couple days of protests. They were more I think, quiet protests where they did walk around the quad. They sat down and educated. They had some signs. Nothing crazy happened there. I don't think I even saw police there at the Utah State events. But Monday night, they didn't start until 6 o'clock at University of Utah. And by the end of the night, we were live on the air till midnight. There were 18 arrests. By the next morning, there were 19. And it was interesting to see it play out because I think that Utah, at least Utah police officers, had a head start on seeing what other states were doing and what other universities were dealing with. They could see what was happening in Columbia. They were doing it different in Texas. And so they had some time to plan and then figure out what they were going to do. I want to note that around, it was probably between 6:30 and 7, I think, 6 o'clock, that Governor Cox, when they had started the protest, said, "We hold dear our First Amendment rights to protest and peacefully assemble. The First Amendment does not protect violence, threats to public safety, property damage, camping, or disruptions to our learning institutions. We will protect protesters and arrest those who violate the law." And then in quick succession, Salt Lake City Police, DPS, and the University of Utah sent out very similar messages, like they'd all had a meeting, and just said, "Okay, we're laying down the law, and this is the law." We're going to start with the law enforcement family, with Mara on this. You've probably had some discussions with the former chief. Were they smart in how they went about this, or were they too tough out of the gate before they knew police needed to be involved?
You know, I mean, we've been having, I'm going to try and get to like untread territory because I think this topic has come up. A couple of things that I wish we would have done differently. One is everyone is just issuing statements, and that feels like positioning. I would have loved to have seen the chief of police, I'm going to say from the U because I think it was their primary jurisdiction, just come out and talk. Like, just come out and communicate with people.
Like, yeah. On the quad, come on camera?
Yeah, and or however. I mean, it would be positioning too, but I think it's really important in tense moments that leaders lead. And I think we've gotten all, universally, this is beyond this issue, of issuing a statement is not necessarily leadership. So I would have liked them to have taken a bigger opportunity to say, "Here are how the rules of this game are going." And then first and foremost, what I believe the role of public safety is to have everyone exercise their rights, but not unduly infringe or cause harm to anyone else who is not participating in that, right? And I think we all agree on that. The one opportunity missed is, why didn't you sit down with the protesters and say, this is about speech, actually, too. And I like when we talk about speech over protesting, because protesting already has some pejoratives there. Yeah. So, okay, here's what you want to say. You can't say it forever and for how long. But let's talk about what meets your needs, and then what meets the campus's needs, and what meets the students the next day's need, and come to an agreement. We have done that in Salt Lake City before, where you just say public safety is here to meet everyone's needs. It is not ours to weigh in, because what we then start to see is an opinion about why you're protesting. And that really is not the point. The point is, hey, I should be able to use my freedom of speech, but there are time, place, and manner. And why wouldn't we just facilitate this? Some things I thought they did really poorly. I don't know who made this call and if it was thoughtless, but they did the roundup at 9:55. If I were the news media, I would say, "Hot dog, you guys plan this when I will do a live shot at 10. Like, we, as someone who has planned,
they made their announcements then, but they didn't actually clear anyone out till midnight because we were watching.
It opened everyone up to a long shot. I was watching you guys. What it did, this is a common tactic we use, is that we have said before, hey, let's do something when they could go on a live shot. And they opened it up for us, and because of that, the media responded, and we were doing these long-style long shots that frankly weren't doing much. They were grabbing some, and we were doing this kind of new American coverage where it's like, is that a tent? Is that a kid? And it felt very Gawker to me. But there's one other outlet that I want to give some credit to. I was watching some news coverage this week, and I watched a really cool report where PBS TV News got with three, Emory, Brown, and UCLA, three very different campuses addressing this. UCLA, lots of violence, lots of intensity. Brown, for those who are covering, are actually going to consider some of the requests of the protesters, very different approaches. But what I loved about it is I'm like, yeah, where is our student newspaper in this? So I started following the Chronicle. And I don't read the Chronicle very much. What I loved, and I started following several student newspapers. Whenever there was a really big dust up, I went to the student newspaper. The student newspapers, by and large, now I'm speaking blanket, and this, I'm sure there's some dopes out there, but they were able to, I felt, to successfully actually call balls and strikes better than I had seen any national news. They were able to identify and represent the point of view of the protesting students, the angry students, and yet they weren't actually anti-establishment at all. They held firm where the police's statements were. But like something that came up, the first article I read on the Chronicle, the early round of protests, the first night of protesting, seemed to me like they were a little more specific. The second round seemed like it was getting a little more just kind of out there activist driven. But the first night, like one of the key things that this reporter from the Chronicle said was, yeah, they want to talk about 47G. They want to talk about this association that's doing this defense spending. Now, we can go back and forth on the merit of that, but I hadn't heard anyone speak to what the protesters were saying with any substance. It was sort of just an anti-movement. I'm just telling you, the reporting at student newspapers went beyond let's make headlines that there's going to be some violence or that there's going to be these two sides. I just thought student newspapers did a really good job.
They did a good job, and I think before I don't want to interrupt you, but I think it was important to note too that we tried to talk to people, and we did a story a couple days later about what their issues were and have the university listen. But I'm super aggravated by the students who go out there and protest, but they don't want to talk to you and tell you what they want. They don't want to talk about what the issues are. They don't want their face on camera anymore. And I don't think they're wearing masks at this point to protect from COVID. They just don't want to be identified. And so it's really frustrating because we wanted to talk and talk about issues, but they were like, why are you here? Get the camera away. And I'm like, okay, well, why are you out here? You're out here because...
to get attention.
Yeah.
So we're here to hear.
So they wouldn't talk.
But here's where law enforcement could intervene in a meaningful way. Law enforcement can facilitate the use of permits. And when you get a permit, you have to put a contact person. And when you get a contact person, you have a person to speak with and negotiate with.
Yeah.
And had we gone less to this headline, are we going to let them, are we not, and more just made it procedural and said, listen, okay, we're going to let you protest every day for 69 days if you want, but you can only have three people and we need a point of contact. And we'll, if it was about facilitating and not clashing, because what the students who just wanted to aggravate wanted was a clash. So why didn't we show up and say, okay, let's make this?
Yes, Greg, we've interrupted you. You get a turn.
Interrupt? I haven't been able to talk on this issue yet. I have yet the chance. I have a question first.
Okay.
What law was broken that they had to call in law enforcement at the U? Are they not allowed to protest on the grounds? Were they damaging something?
What was the law enforcement issue? Because when they started laying out code, I believe it was that you couldn't camp at the university. And there were people on social media being like, well, you let people camp on game day. And what about the homeless people? You don't kick out downtown.
The protesters hadn't taken out a permit.
Okay. So I don't think there is a camping permit at the U.
I don't know.
I don't know that law enforcement, to Mara's point, where there should be some better conversations happening. And what are you here for? What is this issue? What is it? Not protesting, but what are we? What was the word you were using? Not protesting has a, was it
free speech?
Free speech.
They have the First Amendment.
One is a pejorative,
and one
is
not. So I don't think you need any law enforcement in those moments. And frankly, I think the way the universities have been teaching these kids and what they've been teaching them, they created these little monsters that want to yell and scream and not have thoughtful debate. So let them handle their campus and their issues as long as people are not being harmed, as long as people aren't being injured, as long as people property is not being damaged. If there's not a law being broken, like a real one, not an administrative one, I wouldn't even call the law enforcement in because it escalates the situation. So I think that if they want to have those debates or whatever they're doing, great, have it. I think on the University of North Carolina campus where these kids from this fraternity didn't want to see the American flag thrown down again for the second time. They surrounded it. They kept it up. It's gotten incredible attention. But if that's what we're doing
now. Those frat boys, they have like a half a million dollar party coming their way.
I don't want to be saying, oh, look, they protested over here. Oh, look how great the frat boys are. I'm saying if they can all be present around each other and have their opinions and their positions, great. It's when the damage starts happening. It's when people are being harmed or property's being damaged. That's when you bring in law enforcement, not beforehand. And I just think that you got, I think you got to weigh that. I think it's got to be very careful when you bring it in. Now in UCLA, the reason that got violent is they had, so the pro Israel people came in and they wanted to confront those that were saying the opposite, and things got violent in that spot. And that's where you're going to need to have law enforcement step in. But at the end of the day, I just think that if you look at the numbers, and I think you reported these, so many of these so-called protesters aren't even the students. There's people just riling people up. So out of 19,
and yeah, the 19.
Out of the 19 people arrested, 14 were not students. I mean, and that's not just here. They're finding that is the case in many of these so-called campus moments, is that there's a lot of outside people coming in and ginning it up and getting this stuff going. And so I don't know, Mara, that it's the thoughtful, you know, debate of ideas or battle of ideas that you're calling for. This isn't meeting that standard.
Calling for that. You and I are saying the same thing.
Yeah.
There is no need showing up, particularly with riot gear, which is malarkey. No one at the U. This was not an out-of-control riot. Showing up with riot gear is an escalation tactic that's just unnecessary. You could have just showed up. What do you care if you're out there for an hour or 10 hours? That's not a classroom area. Greg, you and I are actually agreeing. Yeah. We're saying, let it go. Now, you watch it. Be aware of it. I'm not saying leave.
Were they nervous because of what they'd seen at other universities, do you think?
They're nervous because their chiefs are using antiquated tactics about use of force that are uncalled for in America anymore. And what's interesting is you saw this funky hybrid where when, not in Utah, but in other states, half of the protesters were this anti-police brutality, or I don't know their names, but the police brutality things. You know where they knew they had an opportunity is because a bunch of cops show up in riot gear, and it's just so unnecessary. It wasn't called for in Utah particularly.
Yeah, at some of the schools, it seems like it was time for police to come in because there were students being blocked.
But it had been escalated.
In Columbia, they went and took over buildings, and you saw the mistreatment of that. You saw those janitors that were held against their will.
Absolutely.
And then that lady came out. This is actually probably funny, but not funny. She comes out. She's actually an associate professor.
From Columbia.
It's just like, you know, we have student meal carts. We need some humanitarian aid here. We are dying of thirst and hunger. It's like, no.
Walk across the street.
If you took over the building and you barricade yourself in, I don't know that the meal card's applying here. And then I read on X or whatever, people are funny. From the river to the streets, we will have our Uber Eats. And what a beautiful chant. Just mocking it. But I do think when you're taking over buildings, when you're holding janitors against their will, you've crossed the line and you got to do something about it.
But that's an easy call. We're all going to agree on that.
Yeah.
But again, it's...
Can I ask this rhetorical question? So in 2020, we had the riots that were downtown Salt Lake, and there was a delay in terms of there was damage to property. There was a police car on fire. You didn't see a proactive prevention of or addressing those issues right away.
Well, I believe that was a choice. My sources said the mayor asked the police to stand down and let it happen.
I met officers that had things thrown at them, that some had stitches because they were standing there trying to keep people from entering the city building, but they were not to engage the crowd. They went up to the Capitol. There was vandalism. Have we learned from that? And that is why we are starting to respond to these potential protests that could turn into riots better now? Or was it the topic they were protesting then was more palatable for the type of rioting versus this one, which is Palestine versus Israel? We cannot tolerate it. We're coming in with the heavy hand. You're not going to do it. The other one, well, we can kind of see why you'd be that mad, so we're going to let it go. Or did we learn lessons from 2020 that they're applying in 24? I don't actually know the answer.
I think they did apply some of the lessons. Because they used that same idea of a curfew and a warning, we'll push you out, and then we'll arrest you if you don't, which seemed to happen at the campus again. Whether it was the right choice or not, it seemed to be the playbook that they kind of eventually used that night. I don't know.
2020, 2024, Salt Lake City notably has upped their escalation. They've bought armored vehicles. They've bought a bunch of tear gas stuff that we've never needed. If you go back to the next one, Occupy was hard because it was hundreds of people who were officially camping. That was a nonviolent breakup. And if you remember,
I remember the chief going tent to tent and talking to people.
He stayed all night and he's like, what do we need here? Because you can't stay, but I'll give you what you want. Tell me what you want.
Even an arrest. I remember, and I think him saying, I'll arrest you if that's what you're looking for. If that's what you want.
And to Christopher, it was like, tell me what your needs are. you can block the street for 10 minutes. But I think what happened is Salt Lake City has moved away from those.
Okay.
We do have really good tactics. I think law enforcement is really sharp right now.
Yeah.
And I think you saw in other states really smart policing where they were doing what exactly you said. They were monitoring. They were giving people enough room that they weren't a part of the story, and they only intervened when they were honestly worried about health and welfare of other people. Otherwise, they were like, there's not a role for us while you're doing this. And I think in Salt Lake, we've worked on escalating tactics here, and I don't think it's successful. I think that's what we saw at the U, and we didn't see it at Utah State. And I think the intervention difference is the tactics of the police. And I didn't see it escalate at the U to the point where we needed that. To your point, I mean, and when we talk about inconvenience, I mean, this weekend, apparently 5th South is going to be closed for 3 days from a monster truck thing. I find that very inconveniencing. But they have a permit, yeah, and people want to go to it. So I'm just saying we can tolerate a lot if we just put a little more parameter. And you're not going to see the police show up at the monster truck show.
I think the show of strength early on before things get out of hand probably helps, though. I do.
I don't think that is a data-driven analysis.
Well, you said that what they learned from 2020, letting it go, they wanted to be prepared. They have more tactical things.
No, we used use of force.
Yeah.
The 2020 came in by starting to show force in an area we didn't need to.
Oh, no. 2020, they were just destroying everything. Nobody was lifting a finger.
Right. That was because Salt Lake City police are run by politicians.
Yeah, but I believe the mayor.
That's what I'm saying.
What
they want
down,
to do, yeah, is not have a repeat of that. So they want to show a little more strength. Like, we're not going to let this get crazy, right?
No, I don't think so. I think that nobody's is setting rules, and really, who was calling the shots? I believe had to have been the University of Utah police this time because it's their jurisdiction. If it wasn't them, then hey, shame on you, University of Utah police.
It'll be interesting to know. And I guess what I'm looking for at this point, because as I'm watching, I love the idea of young people having empathy for what's happening in the Middle East and watching what's happening in Israel and what's happening with Palestine and Hamas. But the problem is the empathy for some of their protest is lost in who they're messaging. I mean, take, for example, that girl who wanted humanitarian aid. I'm like, should you call it humanitarian aid when there's people who actually need it? And they start to seem like SNL skits as opposed to protests with where they have like real desires for change. I know the University of Utah has talked about, you know, sitting down with students because they have $1.5 billion they invest. And some of that probably is invested in companies that probably have connections to Israel or
And I got no problem with that. That can't become a stigma that you're invested in companies attached to Israel. I don't think. I think that's you, they can talk about all you want.
Yeah.
I think
the question is, do they have that conversation? And they did say that back in the 80s, a lot of universities divested when they were looking at the issues going on in Africa at the time. And so they divested and got out of that area. So the question is, does it happen this time? Did students only want to be on camera for a few minutes and that was it and the party's over with? Or will there be real conversations? And I guess that's the interesting thing to see what happens.
But I think
next,
that's the challenge because, I mean, we actually teach a course in social discourse. And what I've always said is there's two components to it. And one is this speaking truth to power. There is something truly American about saying, mm-hmm, I am going to gather. I mean, the reason that the freedom of speech was 1789, where even, you know, individual right to carry is only 50 years old. But freedom of speech is so fundamentally American. We protested our way out of the UK, right? So it's so fundamental. But it's only one component. And Greg knows this. If all you do is like something on Twitter or go to a rally, and you don't show up Tuesday night at your council meeting and have an earnest discussion about change. And I think that's what you're saying, Heidi. Unless you can be serious about this, because the anti-apartheid stuff had some specificity. And as I used the Brown example earlier, the Brown students started this discussion in 2020. And they have a list of 11 companies that they, specific companies, that they would like the university to invest in. I don't have any idea whether they should or shouldn't, mm-hmm, but you can enter into a dialogue about 11 companies. You cannot divest from Israel. That is not a thing.
No.
And it's not even grounded in sensibility. And a really good example of that is you could never invest in an index fund again. And universities, please don't not invest in index funds. We need that energy for scholarships. But a really good example is in 2017, Pepsi bought one of the largest soda factories in Israel. So would you like the U to sell their Pepsi? No. Like, get to what you want. I think your grievances should be heard. Your voice should be respected. But there's two components to change. And one is let your voice be heard. But the second is get serious and show up in a forum where you actually want to achieve something.
Yeah, I think seriousness is the real issue, because I think some kids are out there posting pictures being like, Mayday, look at me in my cute scarf that looks like I care. Or when you listen to some of the protesters list off the divest from Israel, but then they start going into, and this school should like be burned to the ground because of colonialism. That's and right. the way. And it's like, okay, well, what's your issue? Be specific, research it. So I respect whether they're right or wrong. Having real issues to talk about, but it feels to me like it's just sort of the new chance to be like, we hate everything and everyone's wrong and let's burn it to the ground, which I'm like, is this going to help anything? I don't know. But I do think it's going to hurt or help probably Biden or Trump as we move into this election cycle, because people are getting frustrated.
If you want to handicap this on a political party level, this is terrible for the Democrats, because you're talking two demographics within the Democrat Party. You're talking about, I think that Jewish people in America, I think like 75 to 80% of them would identify as affiliated as a Democrat. This pro-Palestinian movement is not a Republican or right-of-center movement. It is all within that left that this is going on. I saw a statistic that was startling. 36, I think this came from CNN, so you should be proud of me that I know a CNN shared stat. Anyone, likely voters 36 years of age and younger, 80% of them disapprove of Biden's handling of the Israel-Gaza conflict, thinking that he should be more aggressive towards Israel. So 80% of likely voters younger than 36 years of age and younger, that's not a good sign, okay? But, okay, if you flip over there, what do you do with the Jewish people in your party, the donors, the people that say, well, we do have a right to exist, this whole idea that we can't? Look at Hamas's charter. It basically means they're supposed to not exist. So I think this hurts the Democrats. This is tearing them within with their strong demographics and the people that are within that party. It hurts that party a lot.
Well, you saw that Biden responded finally. Like, he has been...
He was quiet for a long time.
He's said side comments but not addressed it. And what you saw him do yesterday is really start to address it. So to Greg's point, yes, it's a thing, and people better pay attention from a political perspective. What was interesting about Biden's statement is, if you had to tilt it one way or the other, and I'm just using headlines, he was pro-Israel. Like, he sort of tipped and said, no, we're not leaving our friends here.
You haven't changed my mind, essentially, he said, and don't break the law.
Now, I do think the war as it is unsustainable, just from a human perspective. So it's May now, and I just think that the boots on the ground perspective is unsustainable. Yeah. People are suffering, and I'm purposely not naming the people, because to some degree it doesn't matter. People are suffering.
People are suffering.
So,
you know, this, if you go back and you look at headlines and you look at this discussion about, you know, Palestine, self-governance, two-state, you know, PLO lost its election to Hamas because PLO, Palestine Liberation Organization, and Arafat, they were coming to accept the concept of a two-state rule, okay? So what happens? They get voted out by Hamas that says there should only be Palestine and there should be no Israel whatsoever. This I don't know where you, if you're in Israel, I don't know where you go from there. I don't know what peace accord we think that is going to happen. And it was John Kerry over there trying to forge this before it was now. This issue will not go away the way that Western world would love it to, and that is a nice flowery peace accord, and everybody comes together.
We can't solve the Middle East
that
problems.
That one has to have a winner and a loser. I'm afraid to say, you might not like it, but I think you got to have a winner and a loser in that conflict, because I don't think they're hugging it out there in any generation, in any time.
It'll be interesting, because Netanyahu is also almost unable to to see the government as well.
Yeah.
So like the political unrest there is an interesting.
Well, we do have to move on to other things, but I still see that picture pulled up on your phone of the frat boys. And I think that just to end this, I think the interesting thing with that picture that's kind of gone viral of them holding up the American flag after there, you know, was fights between groups of students that were pro-Israel and others that were pro-Palestinian. I think some of those frat boys were actually Jewish, they said in their interviews, and were there originally because they were supporting Israel. But I think that when you see this fighting and the nastiness going on, people have reacted with some happiness and some ease, just seeing some kids standing up for the USA. There was something about America the Beautiful that people liked about that picture.
We probably are on this topic too long, but just so that this doesn't get just demeaned into frat boys just trying to cause trouble or have fun, there was a tweet or an X post by a kid named Guillermo. Okay, his parents immigrated here, but he grew up in a military community. And he said, I don't know enough about Israel and Hamas. But what I couldn't see is Chancellor Roberts came out here with security and university police to restore the American flag back up. And after the chancellor had done it, they were taking it back down. And where I grew up, what this country has bought for my family, I didn't want to put up with it anymore. And that's his story. So there's a substantive story behind this picture of him seeing his fraternity brothers coming with him and stopping them from taking that flag down yet again. By the way, I heard that Chancellor Roberts' mother is Cokie Roberts, which is interesting.
I don't know that.
Interesting little FYI.
I think it's
FYI.
Maybe a little taste I of the 9/11 Cokie feeling Roberts. We had afterwards. 9/11 was not fun, but the part afterwards where everyone was on the same team was fun.
It's kind of going to.
Just as a reminder, is from a fine Democratic family.
Yeah,
in
no,
Louisiana.
She. I know. But I used to listen to her when those Sunday morning talk shows. I actually thought they were trying to call balls and strikes a little bit and be
back equal, in the day,
even-handed. But I'm. But I just say a lot. There's so much with the GoFundMe fund, and I just don't want to make it look like they're
a bunch of dudes.
Yeah, I don't want to demean what sentiments got them to do what they did. I think they really did draw a line with the craziness around them or what they saw as crazy. They didn't want to do it. They didn't want to stand up. They won't watch it anymore. So they got involved. And so I love it.
I do hope as a mom they don't spend their $500,000 all on alcohol. And that maybe they have a
there
party.
Will be alcohol poisoning if
and
they
then
do. They cannot
they use
do
the
that.
Money for scholarships or something good.
Yes.
Feeding the homeless. We got to move on because we've been talking about this interesting divide that I think the issues we've been talking about are going to cause an election, and maybe even for Democrats or President Biden. Republicans are having a bit of a divide here in Utah, and when we look at the Utah GOP convention, there seemed to be an anti-incumbency wave that we saw in that there are a lot of people who are going to go to primary. Cox will be primaried, Celeste Malloy, Blake Moore, Curtis, all sent to primaries. And so I want to talk about this. First of all, we were talking about the mess that it was. I think some people, you know, thought it was fun. I don't think that everyone thought it was fun. There were accusations that the GOP convention also was R-rated and there was naughty things happening there. Greg just rolled his eyes. Yeah. So there's a whole lot going on at this convention. So the question is, has the convention lost the way? What's going to happen? We're going to go through all that. But I want to start race by race. CD1, Paul Miller will primary Blake Moore. Any interesting insights from inside the palace walls?
I would just say that Blake Moore has a base of unpopularity, because I don't think that Paul Miller did a whole lot of aggressive campaigning. But I think that there was an alternative to Blake Moore, who's in House leadership and is probably making votes that the conservatives don't want. And so to push him into a primary and get 55% without very much campaigning, I was actually surprised that he got 55%, but it doesn't surprise me that he got enough, that Blake Moore did not secure 60%+ of that convention. That doesn't surprise me, but there is without much work, there is some discord with the conservatives in Congressman Moore's district.
I agree with Greg that this was an example of not having a spectacular, even delegate-driven alternative. This was just throw the bum out. What it shows you in terms of like six-dimensional chess that the delegates are playing to no end is that Blake Moore is one of the bright spots in terms of Republican leadership for a small Western state. I mean, he is now officially moved into a leadership position earlier than anyone, and that
quickly.
Just seems insane that the Republicans delegates don't see that.
Yeah, I don't know if
or
that's
don't
something.
Value it.
Yeah,
they
I don't
see
know
it.
If they
well,
value
like
it or
he
think
votes,
about it.
So
going,
it doesn't matter.
He votes Republican.
That's
Yeah, no. And if you're a portion of Republicans that are purist,
it's not a purist. You have a minority of your Republican caucus voting with all the Democrats to pass things, it doesn't feel like a majority of Republicans are getting it done.
He didn't pass the purity test.
That's not purity.
So I want to talk about the purity test because what defines a Republican seems to be the squabble that's going on right now in CD2. We talked about Senator Mike Lee's 11th hour endorsement pushing Celeste Molloy possibly last week into a primary with newcomer Colby Jenkins in CD2. It happened. And Senator Mike Lee is, to what I understand, who were at the convention, he was there all day long. He was at the booth there. And we're learning that Celeste Molloy saying in an interview with the Deseret News that she didn't know that this endorsement was going to be coming from her colleague to another person. And so there seems to be a little infighting here. And in that article, Celeste Molloy told the newspaper, you know, I'm not in here to get home runs every week, something to that effect, that, you know, I'm in here to, you know, get a base hit sometimes or just, you know, move the conservative process along. We're not always going to get what we want. And Mike Lee, it seems like on the other side, has said it's all or nothing. You know, we really need to be getting those home runs. And if we're not, we need to be, you know, shutting down some of these bills. And so the question is, what's going to happen now? Mara, we're watching this happen. We're going to have a primary. It'll be interesting to see. What's your insight on what's happening here?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because they are both continuing, Lee and Molloy, are continuing this fight in public, which is unusual. I do think they represent both sides. The purity, take no prisoners, have it be all capital politic. And Molloy, who's saying it's not all politics for me, some of it is policy. You did see her attract Congressman Owen's support during that. The interesting thing, just to go back to the topic of what does it mean to come out, I think Greg and I would both agree that Congressman Moore is incredibly likely to be successful in a primary. I don't know if that's true of Molloy just because of her challenger. Her challenger, unlike the others, he did work. He has a record. He's asserting an agenda. Like, he's running a 360 campaign. Like, yes, he's running a campaign. Is. So I do think that the voters in that district, and she has not, she had a tough track in that she just got elected, 11 months ago? So she's sort of a quasi-incumbent. Like, she's not a full-on.
Only halfway there.
November, December, January, February, March, April.
Six months ago. So she's an incumbent and not. And she's got a legit challenger who's actually bringing up legit issues. The Lee stuff, I'm not going to speak too much. I think it's pile on. I think Lee's full of it. But I think that if you just look at the candidates, I think Molloy has a challenge.
This
with
is where
a
we
legit
need the YouTube channel so I could look at the camera and laugh when she says that. So I can, well, I don't have to interrupt
her.
I can
I'm
just look at the camera.
I'm speaking to the two people actually running and not the peanut gallery. But like, she has a legit challenger.
I wouldn't demean the senator. I think he has a right to weigh in, as many have.
He
has become very loud on social media of late.
I think that if you are a member of the Senate and the Democrats enjoy one vote majority, this incrementalism that was described by
Congressman
Molloy,
incrementalism,
doesn't apply in the Senate. If you are in the Senate and you have a one person majority, you don't have to hear the impeachment of Mayorkas. You get everything you want, really. They don't really have to find some of this process that you're describing. I think that the Democrats are mastering Washington, and that if they are a one-member majority in the Senate, they get what they want. If they're a one-member minority in the House, they get what they want. I don't know that that's the way it ought to be. I think if you have the majority, you should be just as the Democrats have it in the Senate, and they get what they want. If you have the majority, even if by such a small margin, you should be the majority and get what you want by the majority of your caucus. If you have to take a minority of your Republican majority and team up with all the Democrats to get something done, I don't think the Republicans are running the show at that point. So I just have a different take on that. I think that it's worth, because of the times we're in and things seem to be tough, and I don't know how a $34 trillion debt trajectory keeps going the way it is without some hard reset. I don't know. I think these are appropriate times to have these uncomfortable conversations.
I think this is a nice distinct contrast right now because, again, I think I'm a split ticket voter. I always have been. But I believe what's most important to me is that not if I agree on everything, but whether I think my elected official will default to a position that says I think what I'm going to do is the best decision for my constituency. And what I see now is a series of calculations that are only what's best for my party. And I just have no interest in someone who's mapping to the party over the people.
I think warrantless surveillance through FISA 702 and extending that, I don't think that's a party building
vote. Yeah, but you know it's not that simple.
It's wrong. It's wrong.
Greg, you know it's not that simple.
Well, I don't want to revisit our past debates on this. I would not reauthorize that.
You can't sit here as the former Speaker of the House and say, oh, yeah, every vote sits alone. No, and that's a ridiculous assertion.
We've spoken about that, but there is so much that is a more immediate threat to this nation that's getting ignored before you start surveilling without a warrant American citizens. I don't really want to get into that part. I'm saying I don't think that's a party building partisan vote. I think there is a conscientious policy objection to that.
And what I like
vote.
Is that we're showing people a distinct contrast.
Yeah. And I think the interesting thing too, Republicans are going to have a problem where they're each running saying they're going to cut the budget, they're going to cut the federal deficit.
Yeah.
And the problem is then they get in office and they do what most of them do, whether it's Representative Malloy or Representative Moore, they're voting for what they can get done at the time. What Senator Lee is doing is sticking with that promise that he would get rid of it. But by means of that, you're voting no on every bill. So the question is, how do you get in there and actually fulfill the campaign promise of cutting and getting rid of some of that spending? The question is, who's doing it right? The one who's saying, I won't vote yes on that, or the one who's saying, okay, well, this might be less bad and I'll vote for it. So Republicans are going to have to figure out which way is best way on that.
Yeah.
CD3,
or we could just, you or know, we could have just, a majority of
or
Democrats.
Just let the Democrats run everything like they're doing now. Just, you know.
CD3, we haven't talked a ton about this, but Mike Kennedy going to be heading into a primary there as well. Any great insight that came from this one?
Yeah, so Mike Kennedy got north of 60%, so he is the Republican Party nominee. He has access to the crowded race in Deschutes, but he gets the mass mail with the Republican parties in Deschutes, which makes it less expensive to mail. He has the lists of delegates, all the lists that the party has that will be his, and the other Republicans that got on through signature are not able to have. But it's a crowded race, and you have people like Case Lawrence, a newcomer, but spending a lot of good money and I think has a smart narrative. He's done well.
Yeah.
Or is doing well in terms of his media buys are aggressive. His message, I think, is right. You've got John Dougal, our auditor, who got signatures. And then you have J.R. Byrd, who's also. So I put a lot of weight in having the resources to introduce yourself to voters. You could be the best candidate, but if no one knows who you are, then you're never going to win a race. Those three have, I think, the resources to introduce themselves to voters to make that decision. State Senator Mike Kennedy will have to raise a lot of money and even to keep pace with those other three that got on by signature. So that'll be a good race.
Yeah, this is interesting because three of the four of them are experienced campaigners. And primary still, you are greatly benefited with experience in convention and primaries.
Yes.
Like how to use your resources, how to stay focused, how to work voting voters. And voting voters are different than voters. And like, how do you target? How do you use your resources? So since three of the
they
four-
have less than 60 days to do it. It's
well,
quick.
And then you have the fourth one who maybe doesn't have experience, but he's been using his resources so well.
Yes.
So three have advantages by experience. The fourth one appears to be doing a really smart race. And four is a lot of small votes and a lot of probably a plurality win.
Will win. Yeah.
Right? So a plurality win is for sure the next representative from our state. So I think this is the most interesting race to watch.
The one takeaway from this race I will be most interested to watch is I do believe that there's a grassroots component to all of these races, given especially since the convention to the primary is really just 2 months, and then you get ballots mailed early. So the runway of how you introduce yourself is pretty challenging in such a short amount of time. Does the success that Mike Kennedy saw in that convention where he was at 60% north, are those grassroots in every neighborhood, is that something that he can use to give himself an advantage in a crowded race? Grassroots wise.
Here's the other thing. When you're inside the party, there's usually, particularly in Utah, there's not huge differences in platform. It's not like one guy says, geez, Louise, I'm way over here. So it becomes highly nuanced about appeal and energy level. And just like, I trust that guy and I don't trust this guy. And this person's experience resonates. So it is very much a how I feel about someone decision, not because everyone in this field is equally conservative. Mm-hmm. Everyone is equally Republican in many ways. So it's much more nuanced about what tips you to vote for them.
Yeah.
There was one weird moment there where John Dougal and Chris Herod, two candidates, withdrew and endorsed a relatively unknown candidate, Zach Wilson, not the quarterback from the Jets now with the Denver Broncos, with your Broncos, Mara.
He's from the Sandy City Council, former firefighter or current firefighter, I forget.
So they got out and they endorsed him. I don't understand what that was all about. I've not spoken to either one of them, and I know them both, but I'm curious to understand why they withdrew and got behind him, and if they thought a fifth person in that race keeping Mike from getting a 60% was somehow an advantage, but why?
I thought they were trying to dilute Kennedy.
But to what end? I don't get it.
Yeah.
Maybe for John, because John was in the primary with the signatures. Yeah. Okay.
It seems like the cleanest race is going to be Congressional District 4. Burgess Owens came out, the party nominee, and also on the ballot with signatures, too. The other one that is getting fought out in the courts as we speak today on Friday, the gubernatorial race, Phil Lyman easily won the GOP party nomination. This comes as we know that Governor Cox has very high approval ratings, and I mean, this is his race to lose. But the problem now is Phil Lyman is fighting to make sure that he has a lieutenant governor candidate on the ballot because that day has come and passed. The governor's office had an independent voice look at the idea of whether, is it Lane Bangeter? I've just forgotten his name.
It is Lane Bangeter.
Lane Bangeter, whether he can actually be a candidate because has he lived in the state for 5 consecutive years before running, or could have just been 5 years at some point. And so now we've got the courts looking at this to see if he can be put on the ballot. It's also putting a pause on whether those ballots can be printed. So a lot going on. Greg, what do you think?
I think the language in the Constitution means you have to live here for the last 5 years. But the challenge is, will it disqualify Phil Lyman because he does not have a ratified lieutenant governor as required from the convention of the those that are getting the convention nominee? Does that have the ripple effect of taking him himself off of the ballot, which would be a pretty stiff penalty?
Yeah.
And I think that actually courts look at that. Will the people be robbed of a choice in an election because of something like that? And it's also a little ironic for me because I think I've lived through a moment like this where I had a candidate who needed to be a registered voter to affiliate with a party that they wanted to seek the nomination from and had to register to vote after the filing was over. But because the convention had chosen her, because they had kind of said, this is who we want.
We're talking about Celeste Molloy, race. But people have made memes about
this. Because that happened, I mean, you have an example of our courts just recently saying, we want voters to have a choice. You have a party that chose someone. She had to register to vote so that she could affiliate as a Republican after the filing deadline was over, which there's no gray area in that law, but they did it. I'm just saying, how do you do it one way back in June or July, whenever it was litigated, and then turn around here and say, sorry, Phil, you're out. Your guy doesn't make it. It's a quandary. I like reading the plain language. I would have said that it wasn't done right before, and it's not right that Lane Bangeter doesn't qualify today, but there's other factors.
My thinking on why this is slightly different is, one, that Phil Lyman was notified during filing that there was a problem, where there was a question about what the elections office had told Celeste Molloy. The other thing that's really important is that who governs a federal election is federal law, and that's what you're mapping to. Who governs a state election is state law, and the state law, good for Utah, is more clear. So, I mean, I think that Phil Lyman's directive was much more clear. The other thing is there is precedence in Utah for having had this happen before where gubernatorial candidates hadn't reached the qualification and they were later taken off the ballot. But I do think this is right in that it is a question for the courts at this point.
Yeah, I do want to say, though, that the federal, if you want to run for Congress, there is no residency requirement whatsoever. And some people conflate that with Celeste Molloy saying, well, it doesn't have the same residency requirement as the LG. I'm not saying that. The state does have laws that they have on the books for being qualified to file as a candidate, and those apply just as strong, or should, as those for the governor's race. But let me ask you, do you think it disqualifies Phil Lyman if he doesn't have a certified lieutenant governor candidate running mate?
Well, Well, I think that's why I'll be interested to see the court's interpretation. Because
that's what I'm thinking the bigger consequences. Because
we haven't had that experience before. Yeah. And I'm unsympathetic to his plea that says, I've already printed my signs and you will have wasted my money. Because
yeah,
I'm like, dude, read the paperwork. Well, you know. But I do think that's an interesting question of, as you suggested, we are a little in the gray on ratification of an LG. And particularly in Utah, since we run as a ticket and not as an independent Secretary of State. And so it becomes really interesting. And I think it's not in the interest. I mean, I don't think Phil Lyman's going to win. So does he become this interesting symbol? Does he get more traction being denied?
So the interesting twist on this also is that the conservatives were making a really big deal, I thought, this year that I had not heard in the past of the importance of the delegates ratifying the lieutenant governor candidate because they wanted a chance to say yes or no to Deidre Henderson,
right? For the first time, yeah, you're right.
So they were saying, hey, she's got to come up here and make sure we have to actually vote to ratify her as Spencer Cox's running mate.
They raised that.
And they did, and they made that a big issue. Well, I never heard. I didn't stay till midnight, so I don't know. Because it was supposed to happen after. It was on the agenda after the Senate debate, so it had to happen close
to midnight.
It was
late, yeah.
So I don't know how that rolled out, but I never heard any kind of backlash that she wasn't ratified. But if they ratified both, but Phil's candidate now doesn't qualify, and they put all that importance on ratifying by the delegates.
Then they may have cut
I don't know, man. I just think it's a little messy.
It is a little messy.
Isn't it?
Utah's constitution is interesting in that the person who oversees elections is oftentimes running themselves where, I don't know, it's all very interesting.
Now, I will give her some best practices now. She followed, like, absolute best practices by turning it over and designating, in this case, Greg Bell, who was a former lieutenant governor. She early on said, this is not my role. So, to be clear, she has followed best practices.
I would say for future lieutenant governors, maybe not being on the campaign finance committee of another race that's in the same cycle you're in would probably at least you're away from the appearance of a conflict. So I would say there's a couple more steps that probably
could be
taken. I
think if you and I want to deep down go into the appearance of conflicts in the Republican Party in Utah, half the people elected are related to each other, Greg. Everybody hires everybody. We got conflicts going out the nose here.
You're digging too deep. I'm saying I don't think if you're on the ballot, you have to be on the finance committee of another statewide race.
Yeah, I think it showed poor judgment, but I don't know that.
Before we wrap up this exciting convention talk, I want to tackle the issue that there's been some other squabbling going on. Lieutenant Governor Deidre Henderson posted at some point in the evening saying that it was no longer child-friendly to be there. I don't know exactly what was said or what was done, but I saw several reports from people who were there saying, this is not a place you can bring kids. People were mean to them. People said naughty things. There may have been something sexually suggestive. So the question is, are Republicans dirty, rotten, no good losers, or are we becoming sensitive?
There's plenty to criticize that convention for. The 17 hours is unacceptable. There's so much that deserves to be criticized. The so-called nastiness. Look, 10 years ago, my daughter Sophie's 15, and my opponent's speech about me made my daughter cry, made her tears stream down her face. That's not good. I'm just saying to all of a sudden clutch pearls and say, oh, someone was rude or something. There are people that sadly get sharp. They get passionate. That happens. It was even, but one of the people that supported Cox even swore over the microphone, and they had a good chuckle over it. Cox and Deidre did when he did it. I'm not justifying it, but to say that it just landed last Saturday and it's never happened before, it's selective logic. The reason that that convention should be condemned is for how long, 17 hours, and it being so unorganized. They tried to take 4,000 people in a single file line to register them. They were almost three hours plus behind to starting that convention.
So they didn't learn from caucus to
convention? They didn't break out four congressional districts and let them have their respective elections in different places. 75% of the delegates are watching a congressional speeches and votes happen that they have nothing to do with and just killing the day. There is so much of that race, and they've raised more money, have a full-time executive director, and the worst-run convention I've ever seen. So lots to complain about, but the so-called nastiness, I don't endorse it. I've lived through it. negatively. I've had it hurt members of my own family, and it was a long time ago, and I didn't see anybody talking about it then. So just because one candidate feels it last Saturday doesn't mean that's when it showed up.
Interesting. It sounds like they needed some humanitarian aid, some snacks, some water.
Yeah, well, there was nowhere to buy food. Naps. We did.
Conventions
we needed our Uber Eats.
Horrible experiences. And I will just own my lane as my firm ran the Count My Vote ballot measure. And what I am so pleased with is I don't need to spend much energy telling you that the delegate system is broken and the caucus convention system is antiquated, 1923 called. They want the way we organize back. And I just think it's lovely. One of
it's
the bright
a beautiful
spots
cycle
of
that's
the
being
day.
Ruined.
I know, but y'all are ruining it yourself. You're proving how backwards it is. Right. It doesn't work anymore for modern America.
It will.
And so here's the beautiful part. We have the ability to get who we want on the ballot without being held hostage to 4,000 people. Delegates represent 0.004% of registered Republicans.
That's like saying that Congress, the 435 in Congress, only represent a small percentage of Americans.
No,
it's a democratic republic, meaning that neighborhoods elect their neighbor to go do this.
Delegates don't map to that at all. And the bright spot at convention was Dan Hemmert, a senator who used to be a senator. He left. He's coming back. And he marked this change that I was so happy with I'm going to, he was more artful than this, but he essentially stood up and said, y'all go pound sand. I'm not going to play the game you're asking me to play. And it was the first time. Now we've seen people get angry at the delegates. Mitt Romney stood up and said, I don't really care. This was someone who is considered a mainstream Republican, and where what the delegates are risking is that people who represent them may no longer want to petition them because they're so vitriolic, they're so zero sum, they're so entitled. And I thought that this convention cycle for the Republicans just showed how this is outlived life.
It's a hyper focus on a small few. And the way you know is that the Deseret News and the Salt Lake Tribune, with different photographers, had the same exact five people that were protesting in their front page of their stories about how tough it was.
You don't want to defend this convention.
Out of 3,800 people there. No, look, but I'm telling you why I'm not defending it, but it's not because it's the things you just said, entitled and all this other stuff. You know, you said finally the people get what they want. Do you know how much it costs to get signatures? And you have to pay for those. There's no grassroots effort getting the number of signatures
you
need.
Lower the threshold if you think it's too unsurpassable.
This is a money game, and the primaries, if you have enough money, you will always be strong in a primary cycle, and that will still be the case in this primary cycle.
So you think delegates are enabling the average person to get through?
I do.
Oh,
I do. I think absolutely.
You are selling some old stuff right now.
That's how I got in. I didn't get in because I had giant name ID.
Hughes.
I had to win a primary. Actually,
Citizen
I didn't win the primary.
Hughes.
We tied.
Just
and then
to
I
know,
went to the primary.
A lowly man with a 10th grade
it gives
education.
It gives you an opportunity.
And a hope and a dream.
Last question
money does
about
not
the convention.
Dictate your success in a convention, which I like. I like the information.
I saw some people on social media saying that there was time. It was time that if we were going to continue with the conventions here in Utah, that delegates have some kind of accountability where their neighborhoods could know or understand how they voted. Is that something that you can see?
So that's happening in Washington County. So they actually have public delegate votes, which I'm not really. I like the secret ballot, but that is worth discussing to have them since they're representing their neighborhood.
Because if you're going to represent them, how do you know if they're following
right.
through with what they said at their
exactly.
meetings or
so
why you voted for
Washington
them?
County went that direction for that exact logic for their county convention, and so you can just look down everyone who voted and you can see each round how they voted. It's an interesting process.
So I say to the Republican Party, don't be so afraid of letting more Republicans vote. It'll be okay. It'll be okay with more people participating in your system.
When I got, first convention I went to, I think I said 98, but it was 1992, the threshold was 70% and you only had one vote. You didn't have runoffs. So it almost ensured if it had more than two people that you were going to have a primary. So there was and those primaries were held back in September or forward in September. So I don't have any problem. I think that let the high information election cycle go through, let it push out people. I really hate plurality. I hate the thought that 25% to 30% become the nominee, and the majority of those that voted for someone else, and that they didn't win. So, I think that the caucus convention cycle is a healthy process. But we do have to get to a point where we
Greg
have
one
against another.
So Greg and I disagree on this, but I want to focus on an area we do agree on.
Ooh, wow.
We would both like us, we would both like whoever considers these things. We've got to look at the filing period being changed, and therefore we need to look at the primary selection being changed.
Yeah.
So because I think that it was toxic for the session to have the filing period, and the answer to that is going to be, well, we had to be ready for these other political events that happened, then I say we have seen in the state of Utah primaries being held in August. We have seen them being held in September, and that's just in Greg and I's lifetime. So let's reconsider when we have our primaries.
You need a longer period. To your point, Mara, if you want more people engaged in voting in primaries, give everyone a longer runway to make their case to the voters.
Yeah.
And I think we're trying to cram every county convention and the state convention in with caucus meetings and then all of that by the end of June.
Yeah.
Starting in March. And it's just there's not enough weeks.
Yeah, we're all people who are engaged, and I try to do candidate interviews, but I'm looking at how many candidates in each race. And I'm like, do I physically have the time to give everyone the fair and balanced? That's the question. And then the debate commission's trying to figure out debates and how quickly they can get those figured out. So yeah, this is a really short time frame. And again, these debates are going to be happening right as school gets out and the freedom brain is there and moms and dads are not going to care about anything. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. We'll keep talking about it. I wanted to tackle Title IX today, but we just don't have the bandwidth to fight about
Mara
it at this
just,
point.
She just took all my time. So it's her fault.
Yeah, that happens to you a lot.
We'll let you go first next
you don't
time.
Get your
I waited
word.
So long on that.
I know,
first subject.
And I made you stop too. So this was like
okay.
Girls so ganging up on boys, which was totally
you
unfair.
You get the big kid start today.
I did not interrupt you, at least at the beginning. I don't know what happened after that, but I had to fight for
my
life
in
this podcast.
Well, we can talk about the Title IX saving women later.
Yeah, we'll get to that. But until then, we're going to go enjoy some May sunshine and some spring. So we will be back at it again, and hopefully we'll get this video thing. And when I say we, I will get this figured out so we can come to you not just in voice, but
and
in our.
You can see the looks that Greg Hughes gives.
Well,
me.
You know what? I will not interrupt you as much if I can look at that camera and just grimace when you're saying certain things, so that people know I'm not just taking whole
you know
cloth.
What we need to give
the things
you.
That you're saying.
If anyone's been a part of a focus group, often part of the testing is they give you four or five popsicle sticks that have different kinds of emotional feelings on it, and we could just have those, and you could throw up like happy face.
No, that's
sad
too logical.
Face.
I'm just primal. I can't do that.
Truer words.
Yeah, I don't want those. We do those in TV, and they do them for all the anchors and reporters to see how you make people feel. So, we could just do that here. And just so you know, this room gets really hot,
sticks.
And I was happy not to have the camera today because I was so roasty. I'm sitting here without my jacket on because I'm
may
so
I ask,
hot.
You decided you're going to wear a jacket because we thought we were going to do the YouTube. At what point in this furnace we're sitting in did you realize you could take that jacket off?
At some point, I know. I was just like, oh my gosh, I'm dying. So, anyhow, I have my jacket off, and I don't care. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll solve these problems. Thanks for hanging out with us as we squabble and solve all the world's problems for you. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week.